You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 17th of April, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, talking about all things construction, or rather talking about a few things construction. We haven't got all day, have we, Phil? How's it going at your end there?
Okay, yes. What's on our agenda this morning, David? What do we want to talk about?
Well, it's more what you want to talk about. I understand you've been reading Liz Truss's new book.
No, I haven't. I haven't read the book, and I haven't. I think it's the Daily Mail that it's been serialized in, but I haven't seen that. But
I think it probably would be.
I've been reading reviews and extracts in some of the big papers, and heard a long form 80-minute interview with her on LBC radio.
Oh right, okay. No, I haven't caught up with any of that. I understand that you've been warming to her. Is that correct?
That's overstating it. her line in one of the interviews is that says that anyone who thinks that she crashed the economy and it's her fault is either stupid or malicious.
Is that quasi-quoting, wasn't it?
So I think no. She says it's as far as I can understand it, she's blaming the Monetary Policy Committee and the Governor of the Bank of England.
Yeah,
and the deep state. Everyone else's fault and the deep.
Yeah.
But, no, what I found interesting. She's saying anyone thinks she's crashed the economy thinks it's either stupid or it's either stupid or malicious. And I think, well, I'm not malicious, so I must be stupid then. Because I'm sorry, Truss, I still think you crashed the economy. So maybe I'm just stupid. But where she had things to say which were worth listening to was the difficulties that anyone in government, any cabinet minister, you think you're at the top of the tree in terms of power. If you're the Secretary of State for Transport, you can make the trains run on time, et cetera, et cetera. And then you discover you can't because you're not actually running the railway, someone else does that. And you're not even in charge of the highways because that's an agency. And she was saying when she was at DEFRA, she was in the Secretary of State there for a period. She was starting things that she wanted to do. Was told, no, that's the Environment Agency. You don't run the Environment Agency. She said, well, can I do that? No, you don't run that. And this whole thing of agencies, as it was then, and now it's not even the Highways Agency, it's Highways England. It's interesting. It was kind of seen as a right wing construct. A lot of the very first agency I was aware of was the Property Services Agency, which was constructed designed, set up to be halfway to privatization. And then it was privatized. Tarmac as was bought a chunk of it and other people bought chunks of the government's Property Services Agency. And of course, now it's been reinvented and there is a government property agency still, but it hasn't got, the sort of size of workforce that it used to have. But it was the sale of the Property Services Agency, which inspired the government under first Thatcher and then Major, driven by all the, sort of right wing Tufton Street think tanks, beloved of Liz Truss, that came up with this agency as a way to privatize or prepare for privatisation, or if we can't privatise, at least make it more like the private sector, with private sector disciplines and fundings and so on, quasi-private, which is why National Highways is a quasi-private organisation. And actually, all it's ended up doing is, where they have been privatised, we've had to reinvent them, and where they haven't been privatised, it's put them outside the scope of democratic accountability and control. Now, I don't think Liz Truss articulated it even as well. I'm not saying I've articulated it particularly well, but she didn't quite put it in the terms that I've put it in. But I think that's what she was saying, which for a right winger, or at least a free marketeer, libertarian, it's hard to tell really. In some ways, she's quite left wing, but she's a libertarian, but anti, I suppose, when I think, no, she's not left wing, but anti-establishment, how she'd like to picture herself. It's hard to pigeonhole her, I think, as it is with so many of these neocons, but it's almost an anti-market position that she's taking.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a market that brought her down effectively, but she would say, no, it wasn't the market. It's because I wasn't allowed to run the market. It's other people who were running the market.
Mm.
And yeah, big state and conspiracies and this, that and the other. Anyway, I thought what she was saying about agencies was interesting and has some validity. I think the whole issue of how large parts of the, you know, public administration of this country, including Environment Agency and National Highways, does need re-looking at.
Hmm. Well, I noticed, because I had a look at this interview that she gave, I think it was the Sunday Telegraph, where she said the outsourcing of decision-making to technocrats is completely wrong. And it's hard to disagree with that, really. She goes on to say that the level of power that's exercised now in Britain by people who aren't elected is a huge problem. And I do agree with that. When you elect your politicians, you expect them to sort of do your bidding, don't you? But if there's somebody in Whitehall who you've never heard of and certainly haven't elected, well, that seems pretty wrong. So I agree with you. She's got a point.
She has got a point. There is a flip side. We've talked before about the National Infrastructure Commission, for example, which was dreamt up with some sort of hope that if we could take the politics out of, nuclear power stations,
yes, are
a great example, something that takes, 20 years to get out of the ground, and huge amounts of planning, inquiries and political argument and governments change and policy shifts and nothing ever happens. If we could take the politics out of that and have a panel of experts who say, this is what we need and this is where we're going, then all the politicians need to do is just sort of, shut up, get in line and do as they're told. And yes, that's effective, but you can't take the politics out of it. It's inherently political.
Yeah, and it hasn't really worked. So, yeah, I mean, I have to admit, given some of the things she said, I was beginning to sort of nod in agreement. And then I remembered that she says, she favours Trump for the US presidential election. And I thought, well, maybe I was right the first time.
But barking mad people, not necessarily wrong about absolutely everything.
No,
even a stopped watch is
right twice a day. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, interesting. And I heard, and I haven't read this, but I sort of heard it in the background when the radio was on, that she's been saying that we shouldn't have anything to do with China at all. The Chinese Communist Party is out to get us and we should cut all connections with them. And that's the way I heard it anyway. I don't know if that's exactly what she's saying in her new book. And I certainly feel somewhat in agreement with that. If we look at, people are beginning to wake up to the fact that the Chinese Communist Party isn't to be trusted, and we got Huawei to where we refused to let Huawei run out. What were they going to run? Something they were going to run in this country, and we decided to get rid of them. The American
everything,
yeah, everything,
cameras,
yeah,
everywhere.
Not a day goes past that you don't hear something about China infiltrating something or hacking something, and I'm certainly with her on that. But
isn't it interesting how it used to be the broadly speaking the right that were for free trade and globalization.
Oh God, yeah.
And let's get out in the world. And the left that were, union led, protect our local jobs and protectionism and tariffs and, don't, go back to 72. The left didn't want to be in the EU.
Yeah.
Or the EEC as it then was. And that was sort of the split.
Yeah.
And there has always been in British politics, going back to Victorian times, the free trade protectionism split, and we're seeing this again in the USA at the moment, it's been playing out. And Brexit was a big part of that.
Yeah.
We don't want to be, globalised, although some of the Brexiteers saying we'll be more global if we're not in the EU. Anyway, trust was, does, I believe, advocate a slight shutting down with China. And again, that seems to be, the Labour is more, seems to be more pro-globalisation than the right,
yeah,
or certainly the neocon right, because the neocon right see globalisation as equivalent to and leading to all the small boats crossing the channel, people coming in, illegal immigration,
yeah,
essentially,
yeah,
and asylum seekers and out of control, and that's all a result of the global economy.
Yeah. I do feel rather sorry for the Labour Party, who keep complaining that the Tories are cheat, nicking their ideas. I mean, what was the latest one? Oh, it was the smoking ban. You know, there's Rishi Sunak and his much vaunted smoking ban, which of course is unpopular with an awful lot of his own MPs. And there's the Labour Party saying, "Well, that was our idea," and of course they voted for it. It makes it extremely difficult to decide who to vote for when the general election is called in the next few months, whenever that is. Yeah, very difficult. I mean, Truss's book, I suppose it's worth actually mentioning what the title of Truss's book is, because I think it probably says quite a lot. It's called 10 Years to Save the West, Lessons from the Only Conservative in the Room.
I hadn't seen that subtitle.
Hadn't you? Well, I think it's quite interesting, because that subtitle really does tell you an awful lot about, you know, the current administration. You know, are they really Tories in the true sense, in the old fashioned sense? You know, maybe she's got more claim to be a Tory than Rishi Sunak. Although it's interesting you were talking about the rise of the agencies. That would really happened under Thatcher, didn't it? That was
Truss was asked about this. She was saying Major started it, but Blair picked it up and ran with it and took it, took it nuclear.
Okay.
Metaphorically.
Right. So it was more Blair than Thatcher, was it?
But I think it was from the conservative days. It was one of those conservative, big C conservative policies that Blair picked up and ran with, along with the PFI.
Yes,
which of course he, accelerated. But both of those things had their origins in, Institute of Economic Affairs, Adam Smith Institute and all those sort of organizations.
Yeah. But what's all this got to do with construction? Because we're supposed to be talking about construction.
Right, yes. Well, okay. Here's why. She was, one of the things she's talking about is, famously, she thinks one of her big successes was she managed to get a trade deal with Australia, which no one else wanted. She said the civil service were against her, but she managed to get it through. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to hang on the back of this. Well, two things. You were talking about China as well. So trade in general and trade specifically China. She was saying that she's also, no one will be surprised to hear, against the chase for net zero. Mm-hmm. She says she believes that man-made climate change is a thing, but she doesn't support the move for net zero while we are essentially outsourcing our carbon to China. Yeah. China are still building coal-fired power stations to make things for us. We import all these Chinese goods, which have been made possible by their coal-fired power stations. We shut all our coal-fired power stations. We go net zero. We don't make anything. We import everything from China. And as balmy as she is, she's absolutely right about that. That makes hardly any sense. That's what globalism is all about. Globalization is all about. But it doesn't seem to make sense. And this reminded me of a piece. Right, back on UK construction now, I posted a couple of weeks ago. So it's confusing when you see the word British Steel. British Steel is not British Steel. It's owned by Jingye Group, which is a Chinese company. They bought British Steel in 2020. So the Teesside and Scunthorpe British Steel plants, it's not British, Chinese. And they've got planning permission to build an electric arc furnace at the Scunthorpe site. And I think they've got a planning application in to do the same at Teesside. Hang on, I've got the right way around. No, they've got planning permission at Teesside and they've got an application in at Scunthorpe.
Right.
And so this is all about them decarbonising steel production in the UK. So he's got to say, this is a good thing. It's all part of the...
Yeah, net zero... Et cetera, et cetera.
The way we're supposed to be doing things, and the Liz Truss would call it woke blobism. Why do you have to worry about, what's wrong with old steel? Perfectly good enough. Worked for my granddad, worked for me. But we're supposed to be going net zero. And again, this just goes back to Liz Truss. This is what the whole middle ground consensus thinks we should be doing. And can't win an election without winning the middle ground. So we all support this. We all support the middle ground. And thing that really struck me is saying that the Chinese saying we want to do this because we want to, clean up Britain and help Britain go to net zero, and it's going to be great, secure thousands of jobs. It's all great. However, We expect UK government backing. We expect British taxpayers to give us money to do this. Now, I don't know how much. I don't know whether we pay for it all. This is, I haven't seen the detail. I don't know whether any detail of this is made public, but it just seems, yeah.
Yeah.
You think the Chinese are going to come in and save our steel industry?
Well, they said they were going to invest billions, didn't they? I think 1.2 billion they promised to invest. And apparently, I mean, I did a little bit of research about this. They've only spent about 156 million so far. So they haven't actually done what they said they were going to do. And in the first year, they bought it in 2020, British Steel in 2020, previously owned by the Indians, I believe, by Tata. But they bought British Steel and it lost 140 million in the first year of their ownership. I mean, I know it's going to go bust. It's going to go out of business if they didn't buy it. But they haven't actually done what they said they were going to do. They don't seem to have ploughed all the money in, and now they want us to pick up the tab. So I think that's a bit rich.
Do you think there are parallels? I can see differences and similarities between the Japanese car manufacturers, Nissan mm-hmm. in the northeast and Honda in Swindon, and Toyota in Derby, were given huge government tax breaks in the 80s to build massive new modern car assembly plants, basically sticking together bits that had come over from Japan. And they created thousands of jobs and they saved the British car industry. But they were sort of setting up new enterprises here, whereas this is not necessarily the same thing. I mean, should we be looking at Chinese-owned British Steel the way we look at Nissan, Toyota and Honda? Or do you think it's a different case?
No. I mean, obviously, Honda's not here anymore. And in fact, we've got a feature in the magazine coming out next month about what's happening on the old Honda site. I don't know. No, I think well, Honda was certainly making cars. They weren't just bolting them together. And I think Nissan manufactures cars. I think they design cars. I think there are some cars in, you know, being produced by Nissan, which were conceived, designed and built in the UK. I might be wrong about that, but that's my understanding of it. They're getting involved, but they're not really, they don't seem to be contributing, not in a meaningful way. I mean, they might keep a few jobs.
Well, maybe if they get the subsidies that Honda, Nissan and Toyota got, they will.
Yeah, yes, maybe. And that is what they're asking for. So I suppose the only way we're going to find out is if we do shell out for it and let them get on with it and see what happens.
Anyway, this all made me want to look at what's been going on with our trade in building materials. And the 2023 stats came out last week for construction materials. And the trade gap last year between the value of what we import against the value of what we export. We have always basically imported more construction materials, certainly in past, I can only look back 20 years, but I'm sure before then as well.
Yeah.
We've always imported more construction materials than we've exported. And in fact, things got a little bit better in 2023. There was 2 billion, the trade gap shrank by about 2 billion pounds. But in 2023, the UK imported 14.2 billion more construction materials than it exported. Mm. In 2022, the gap was about 16.5. So it's come down, but it's still huge. Mm. And we've talked about this probably this time last year. We talked about it when that big construction 2025 strategy document came out in 2013, the document that set out the whole strategy of government construction policy, which led to the creation of the Construction Leadership Council. The Construction Leadership Council was basically given 4 jobs: cut carbon, cut costs, speed up construction, and cut the trade mm-hmm. deficit. Since then, the trade deficit has gone from 6 billion to last year, 14 billion. So it's more than doubled. It was meant to be, the target was to get it down to 3 billion next year. Clearly that's not going to happen. So you never hear the Construction Leadership Council talking about the trade deficit or
well, you wouldn't, would you?
Export promotion anymore. They've pushed that away. Says no, we've reconstituted things since then. We've got a new agenda with new people and forget about that. And the reason why it relates back to our Chinese conversation is because when it comes to steel, just in the fourth quarter of 2023, we imported more than twice as much steel for fabrication as we exported. We imported four times the amount of sheet steel piling. This is by value, by money. Imported four times what we exported, sheet piling. Steel prefab buildings, all prefab buildings, we import much more than we export. And pretty much all, every category you look at, I mean, we've talked before about timber and forestry. Sawn wood. And just in the fourth quarter of last year, we imported £200 million worth of sawn wood, exported £8 million. So that's probably the biggest gap. Laminated wood, imported £76 million, exported £5 million worth. Going back to steel, I've got a bit of thing. Rebar, we imported 10 times what we export. And I was looking through thinking, there must be something that we import more than we export. And the only, a huge, very long list of all the different product categories. The only thing I could find, I spent about half an hour going through all these numbers with the rulers that are going down, seeing where the export number is bigger than the import. Crushed rock, we export more than we import, which is odd, but not a huge amount. I mean, crushed rock is not a great traveller on the whole.
Yeah, I wonder where it's going.
We export more paints and varnishes, which I think is probably quite a good thing, because I can imagine there's much more value added in paints and varnishes, coatings.
Yeah.
There's more sort of science and tech that goes into that than just steel or timber or raw materials. And we also export quite a lot more zinc building products than we imported, which made me think, I don't know what's made from zinc in a building. What are zinc building products?
Well, it's used for galvanizing steel, isn't it? I don't know. What else? Widgets, I suppose. Little sort of die cast widgets.
Are they all made from steel?
Well, I know. No, I mean, obviously, some things are made from zinc and not steel. I mean, I don't know. Zinc is very good for casting little things. So, yeah, clips, maybe. I've no idea. Yeah. We'll have to get somebody from the zinc industry to let us know. But, I mean, I don't know anything about zinc, and I've never heard of any zinc mines in the UK. But, I mean, I'm not surprised about timber. I mean, we don't have... you know, thousands of square miles of forest in this country.
Okay, well, let's park timber, because we've talked about that before.
Yeah, all right.
We go back to steel in particular.
Yes,
we have a huge, great steel, you know, indigenous steel industry.
Yeah.
And yet we're importing, you know, four times as much sheet steel piling, twice as much steel for fabrication, 10 times as much rebar as we export. As Liz Truss would say about cheese, that is absolutely, what'd you say, bonkers, mad, whatever. It is.
Yeah,
Structurally wrong with British industry that is happening, I think.
But as you quite rightly said, it's 20 years since that target was set and we failed absolutely miserably. I mean, Sorry?
11 years, rather.
2013. I thought it was 2003. 2013. Well, even so, you know, more than a decade. And either people haven't been trying to do anything about the trade deficit or they've been trying and failing. Doesn't seem to me as if there's any likelihood that we're going to see any change in the foreseeable future. I just wonder, presumably that's why the CLC doesn't talk about it, because they've realised that they're on a hiding to nothing. They can't do anything about it, so best just ignore it. I can't see what else they could do.
And also, I've talked before about the export. It's not called the Export Credit Guarantee Department anymore.
Oh yeah,
but there's an arm of government which underwrites exports and is all meant to help exports. And what's it doing? It's exporting foreign contractors for foreign jobs. There's not a huge amount of British win from that either.
No, that's true.
Export policy is lamentable, frankly. Mm. The only people who are doing a good job are our construction machinery manufacturers. We export more construction machinery than we import. We've got a trade surplus in construction machinery.
Well, that's good.
Sort of, but I would like to
see a study.
We're
buying all the raw materials to make the equipment.
Yeah. That's the answer. I'd like to see a study of exactly how much of Britain is in that, you know, British-made Komatsu excavator, that British-made Caterpillar, or even that British-made JCB or Thwaites.
Yeah. I mean, just to go back to Truss and her comments about China, I think, as I said, I broadly agree with her that our dependence on Chinese goods and services needs to be reduced substantially, but it's extremely difficult to do that because virtually everything you buy these days is Chinese. And even, you know, UK manufactured plant and equipment almost certainly incorporates a lot of manufactured goods like components, which are imported from China. You just can't compete with the Chinese on price. That's the problem. You know, if we make it, they'll make it and they'll make it cheaper. And so, you know, that's why that we buy from China, and cutting the purse strings is going to be very, very difficult.
But what's interesting is that no one, I think go back to 2010, maybe Cameron Osborne were promoting this, but no one today seems to be promoting the, right, globalization is a fact. No two countries of McDonald's have ever been to war. Globalization, the Coca-Colaization of the world is inevitable, and it's actually a good thing. Let's embrace it. Let's play to our strengths. Let's, you know, let other people do what they do best, and we do best, and we'll do the science and the tech and the research and the, you know, finance. And that's where, you know, we're going to be a service economy and go gung-ho, pro-globalization, free movement of goods and people, et cetera, et cetera. Or the alternative to that is you close up the barriers, you shut the walls, little England, forget it, but just stay home and fix it all ourselves. No one's going for either of those two. Everyone's trying to negotiate a middle ground.
Yes.
It seems to me.
Yeah.
Now, I can understand why no one's saying, let's just shut the doors and shut up shop. But I am surprised that there isn't a voice saying anymore, globalization is real, it's happening, let's just make the best of it. And I would have thought that's where the Liz Trusses and the Trumps and the neocons and the Farages and whatever. That ought to be someone on the right.
It ought to be, but then you've got
the people on the right are being more protectionist. Reform Party are going to nationalize things. They got on their manifesto nationalizing utilities and things. Strange political times.
It's the world turned upside down. No, I think probably the reason that people are being a bit more reticent about globalization is that globalization means buying more goods from the likes of China and India.
And selling more services.
What, we would sell services to them?
We would sell services. We sell the designs and they would then copy them.
Well, that's happening already. But materials trade deficit is certainly... That's not a problem that's going to be solved overnight. That's going to take an awfully long time.
It's a goner. It's gone. And I think so long as we pursue net zero with the dogmatism that we are currently doing it and others don't, that's going to be the nature of things.
Yeah.
If the world marched in step, level playing field, okay, better. Not happening. Yeah.
But we're leading by example. We're doing our bit and everybody's going to follow us.
What is it? Virtue is its own reward? Is that the expression?
Probably. I haven't heard that one before, but I'm not sure that's absolutely true. Not in every circumstance, anyway. Okay, let's move on from depressing trade deficits. Let's talk about other depressing stuff.
We failed to solve that one.
Let's talk about jobs worths.
That's cruel. That is cruel.
Well, it isn't really. But this is, you've been exchanging emails with certain people about a very strange announcement that we received via email. Tell us about that.
Well, you can see it if you go to the Construction Industry Council website, cic.org.uk, posted 9th of April 2024, a statement saying, clarification on professional construction consultants demonstrating competence. And it's all terribly dry. It starts off saying, Part 2A of the Building Regulations Amendment, England Regulations 2023, introduces requirements for any person who's proposing, blah, 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 blah. And it all sounds very, very dull. What they're actually, when you cut through it, what they're saying is that basically consultants, architects, consulting engineers, structural engineers, building service engineers, going onto construction sites, are getting to the gate and being asked by the security on the gate, where's your card? My business card here, Richard Rogers, architect, Lord. Yes. So Lord Rogers, that's not a card.
Yeah.
where's your construction skills certification scheme card? It says, well, I don't have one of those. I'm Britain's first equal with Lord Foster, most famous architect. I don't have to have one of those. You should let me onto your site. I designed this building. They say, oh, you can't come on this site without a card that says you're a qualified BIC layer or
you've done your CSCS health and safety module.
At least. And the reason why this has become a particular issue, it seems, is that going back to this statement that the Construction Industry Council issued last week, the new Building Regulations Amendment, England Regulations 2023, introduces the requirement that anyone who's doing design work on a building, the client or the client's authorised representatives have to check that they are competent. In other words, I can't go to you, Dave, and say, can you design me a skyscraper and then go and put up that skyscraper. I've got to make sure that you're qualified to design a skyscraper. Otherwise, I'm at fault because I've hired a cowboy to design my building. And that seems to make sense, possibly unnecessary, but someone thought it was a necessary piece of legislation. Anyway, on the back of that, clients and contractors are employing people to check that you, David Taylor, are competent and qualified to do the work that you've done. So it's another tier of vetting. And so these people, it turns out, who are being, you know, sort of CDM consultants and health and safety consultants who are giving advice on the qualifications of their design profession, of the design team and the design professionals, are saying, well, he's a member of RIBA, but he hasn't got a CSCS card, so he's not allowed on site.
These are self-appointed consultants, are they? So they basically they've seen an opening and they think, well, I'll help you. I'll help you vet people, and so they're setting themselves up as gatekeepers, almost literally. Is that fair to say?
That's how I think I said. It's the man who's behind the CIC putting out this statement it's come from their health and safety committee, and the chair of the CIC's health and safety committee is an architect called Paul Bussey. At least I assume he's actually an architect because he works for Alford Hall Paul Monaghan Morris AHMM, famous firm of London architects. And I said, this surprises me. Who's been asking for CSCS cards for you know, architects and engineers visiting site for the, you know, for the design team? And he says it's misinformed contractors and clients who are being advised by so-called CDM or health and safety experts who in turn do, quote, designer competence assessments, unquote, for a fee, or expect CSCS cards for their site access. So I said, oh, okay, who's doing this? Name names. And said, basically, all of them. It's right across the industry, creating unnecessary time wasting and costly designers having to justify their own expertise for others, and others with no competence are profiting from it. You know, people are making money from making architects do work that they shouldn't be having to do.
Do you think that so-called CDM or health and safety experts, do you think that they know that architects, engineers and consultants don't need a CSCS card, but they can see that they can make money by convincing contractors that they do? Or do you think they just don't know? They just don't know themselves.
I think they just don't know. I think it's just ignorance. There's so many regulations and, you know, governing the construction industry, and you say, oh, well, I know enough. I can make a living out of that. I know the work at height regulations. I have to do a risk assessment.
Yeah.
I know how to do a risk assessment, but I don't know the building regs, but hey, something like this. No, I think there's just an awful lot of ignorance.
And maybe contractors are partially to blame for being lazy and deciding just simply to outsource this to a self-appointed consultant rather than do the due diligence themselves.
Oh, a lot of contractors outsource absolutely everything. Yeah. So it's amazing how few people, some
even
of
the big
building contractors employ.
Yeah. Yes.
And they employ, if you look at the, you know, some of the, I'm not going to name names, but if you look at some of these contractors, tier ones,
they literally employ more back office, more admin than people who ever go onto a construction site.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, everything's subcontracted. But, yeah, surely when it comes to something like due diligence, which this is, that should be in-house. You shouldn't outsource something like that. You should get your own house in order so that you know that you're doing the right thing.
Really? If you were being sold a financial product and you had an accountant or a tax advisor, wouldn't you go to your tax advisor or your financial advisor and say,
yeah,
this looks a good investment. What do you think?
Well, that's different.
Otherwise, what are you employing them
well,
for?
Well, yeah, but I mean, yes, if you're going to somebody like a lawyer or an accountant to sort out your legal competence and your financial competence, that's fair enough. These people are professionals. You know, they have this specific expertise and they've got all the letters after their name to prove it. But going to somebody who's just set up in a porter cabin somewhere and saying that I will sort out your health and safety on site for you, I don't think that's the same. I think that's something
I think there's a massive CDM profession out there.
Well, there probably is. Yeah, I'm sure there is.
And they're not in porter cabins. Everyone works from home.
Yeah.
But they've probably got a nice PO box somewhere in Store Street or something.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That's the way it works. Yeah. Well, it is surprising, and I was certainly surprised as you to find out that, you know, architects and engineers were being stopped at the gate and being asked for their CSCS cards. That's just ignorance. Yeah, plain and simple, I think.
You'd thought they could just tell by the bow ties and the red trousers.
Yeah.
That'd be good enough.
Yeah.
Get through.
Yeah, yeah, you can spot them a mile off. Maybe, Phil, we should outsource it to AI and they could sort it out.
Oh.
Get some bot to decide who can come on site.
I see what you've done there.
Well, it's our next topic for discussion. I think just as a closing topic, talking about artificial, I nearly said artificial insemination. I really don't mean that. Artificial intelligence, AI. That's what happens when you live in a rural environment. Actually, this morning, just before we started recording this, I stepped outside my study.
You went out with your turkey base.
No, I stepped outside my study and was assailed by this appalling smell. And I thought, oh no, the downstairs shower drain has backed up again. So I got my sink plunger out and, you know, stuck it down a plug hole and all the rest of it, put on the extractor fan. Then my daughter comes in and I said, I'm sorry about the awful smell. She said, that's all right. They're spreading muck. And farmer outside is spreading muck on his field. And that's what I could smell. Anyway, that's completely irrelevant. We're going to talk about artificial intelligence because you hear an awful lot about artificial intelligence. I get press releases, as I'm sure you do, all the time from people saying that, you know, their latest, I mean, construction plant had an awful lot of construction plant press releases recently because we've got a big quarry plant show coming up. Everybody wants us to write something about it. Everybody's talking about AI and how it's transforming the way they do everything. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I should try that because I'd commissioned an article from somebody who is a very impressive person, works for a leading international research institute, who was going to write me an article about AI. And I emailed his PR person a week before the copy was due in and said, are we still on track for this? And he said, oh, yes, absolutely. What time do you want it on Thursday? And I said, all right, that's very good. As soon as you like. He said, well, I'll email you first thing Thursday and let you know when to expect it. That was when the deadline was. Thursday lunchtime came and went. Hadn't had an email from him. So I emailed him and asked him where the copy was. And he said, oh, they've decided they can't do this after all because their AI research is still ongoing. I mean, it's a pathetic excuse and probably not even true. You know, somebody whose job is to do research into AI in the construction sector doesn't...
It doesn't finish.
No, it doesn't finish. Absolutely.
So is the internet full?
So it was crap. Yeah, I was furious. There was with two pages left empty. So I thought, I had a brainwave. I thought I'd get ChatGPT to write the feature for me.
You cheapskate.
Which, well, why not? I mean, university students across the land are getting first-class degrees courtesy of ChatGPT. So I thought, yeah, okay, I'll see what it says about the benefits and threats of AI in the construction sector.
That was the question you asked it.
Yeah, basically.
You said, what are the benefits and threats of AI in construction?
Yeah. And it came out with a load of waffle, basically, which I'm sorry to say, readers, I've published. I mean, it's going to be out there.
Well, I've read it, and it's no worse than. I mean, it's not waffle.
No.
It's intelligent English.
Yes, it is.
It's,
which is
the sort of thing I've read in other magazines. It doesn't tell me anything. I know nothing about AI, but it doesn't tell me anything I didn't already know.
No, that's the thing.
I don't. My level of ignorance is such that I don't understand really the difference between AI and Google, because I ask Google something, and it's not a person, hiding behind my screen. It's a machine.
Yes,
and the machine which I'm typing this into gives me an answer.
Yeah,
and these days, unlike 20 years ago or whatever. It's normally correct.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I mean, AI is different, obviously. I mean, there's something called machine learning, which I think is probably one of the distinguishing features of AI. Is basically, it's not a static sort of cast in stone technology that artificial intelligence will learn. So
doesn't Google learn? Doesn't Google get better?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. It's got algorithms that do. Yes, that's true, it does. Oh, so, I don't know. I'm just as ignorant as you, Phil.
What I'm saying is I'm not saying that, oh, Google must be AI then. I mean, I'm just saying that it's part of the language.
Yes.
I mean, I have a lot of trouble with jargon. Anyway, go back to modern methods of construction. I don't understand what's modern about it.
No.
But I don't quite. I've even looked it up, and it doesn't really help me because it gets into difficult words. But I don't understand what makes artificial intelligence specifically AI, as opposed to just,
clever
something
tech
that Google does.
Yeah. Well, neither do I. And the 1,000 or so, I think it's more like 700 words that ChatGPT coughed up in a few seconds, I might add, didn't really answer any of those questions. I mean, this is one of the things. It is interesting to see what technology like this can do, because on one hand, it's very impressive. You know, if you commission a freelance journalist to write you a piece, you want it to be well researched, you want it to be well written, and you want it delivered by the deadline. Well, let me tell you, ChatGPT absolutely smashes the third one of those. You can give it any deadline you like and it'll beat it. I mean, literally, I thought I'll ask ChatGPT to write me 1,000 words on AI in construction. And I thought,
Was it exactly 1,000 words?
No. Well, I'll come on to that. I thought I'll let it get on with that, and then I'll check and see later and see how it's getting on. Well, before I could close the page on my computer, I had the copy on my screen. Yeah, it's no good at writing to length. So if you ask it for 1,000 words, it will do as many words as it feels like. So what I've ended up with is actually three articles by ChatGPT written to my specification that I have sort of blended together. I didn't outsource everything, Phil. I did some work on this. I edited it. I changed all the Americanisms to something more like house style, and I did splice in bits and bobs to try and make it flow better. I mean, one thing in terms of research, I've got no idea how good it's or how thorough its research is, but I'm very, very suspicious about some of the quotes in there, because it mentions people like Simon Thompson, president of the Construction Workers Union. Well, I don't know.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. Yeah. I don't know if Simon Thompson does. And then other rather vague things like, for example, Mark Richards, chief technology officer at a leading construction firm. Well, I mean, if Mark Richards exists and is the chief technology officer at a leading construction firm. I'm very sorry because I'm not sure that, you know, I might have misquoted you. It's that sort of thing. You just don't know whether or not these, I Googled all these people, couldn't find them. So I think actually erroneous and completely fictitious stuff is a recognized fault of ChatGPT. I think that's pretty well recognized now. But it's completely brazen. It presents this information, true or not, as absolutely gospel. So that's what I reproduced. And yeah, I got to say that it didn't miss the deadline, unlike my human over at the Research Institute. And in fact, the English, as you point out, is pretty good. The grammar's more or less correct. It writes a lot better than most PR people I know. And I can't complain about that. It's a bit American, but you expect that. I mean, it comes from Silicon Valley after all. So yeah, it's got its pluses and its minuses, but I don't know whether or not we can really extrapolate my experience of getting ChatGPT to write me an article to the experience of your average contractor, engineer, architect, machine manufacturer in the construction industry. They use AI in a very different way. And, I think probably to much better effect.
There has been a lot of, in fact, there are local newspaper, certainly at least one local newspaper group that has made no secret of the fact that it's laying off journalists to go for AI.
Really?
created newspaper reports. I'm sure that it might be true or not. I don't know, but I'm not saying made up in the sense of fabricated. And you and I, David, are among the high up the tree of apparently at risk to AI.
Oh, I'm sure.
Fortunately, I think we're old enough.
Yeah, we'll be retired by the time the actual.
We'll be able to see our years out, hopefully. I'm quite glad that you showed me the article that you've run in the May issue of the magazine. I'm quite glad it wasn't better, because you wanted it to be just well enough that the people were going, why are you filling the magazine with this sort of rubbish? But not so good that anyone thought, why do we need you if ChatGPT can produce this stuff? Yeah. There is not a great deal of value added in this. But as I say, there are plenty of not necessarily printed magazines, because they tend not to spend money on printing their magazines that do this sort of thing, but online magazines, which are full of this. So there are plenty of websites purporting to be news that don't involve real people.
Yeah.
And maybe that we've just discovered the biggest value of this podcast, David, that by virtue of you and us here talking non-intelligent blair that clearly is not an artificial intelligence, we are proving that we actually exist. And therefore we're proving that all the material on Construction Index website and Construction Index magazine must therefore be at least have gone through the hands of humans, because we're here doing it.
Yeah.
And it's not all AI generated. I have no idea how many press releases I get are AI generated. Maybe quite a lot of those.
Quite a lot of what? Press releases?
The press releases. Yeah. Do we think we receive AI generated press releases?
I don't think so. But I do think that you're absolutely right. A lot of things which purport to be news, usually they pop up as links on your social media thing. You think, oh, what's that? And you click on it, and it's utter drivel, clearly produced by a bot. I think that actually journalism, or I think these days it's called content, which is generated by AI, is pretty recognizable. I think I think I can spot it most of the time, but I know, maybe I'm just being naive. I don't know, but I'd say cherish the human error. You know, when there's a spelling mistake or a bit of bad grammar, that's a human brain at work.
Yay! What a relief. I posted a story this morning based on Arcadis's annual look at which is the most expensive cities around the world to build in. And the story basically is that London has come out on top, which it often, but not always, does. And my headline said, London, most expensive city in the world. And my first paragraph said, London is the most expensive country in the world.
There we are.
It took an email from someone to go, heads up, yeah. Typo.
There we are. It's all done by humans, handcrafted by humans.
Anything else from you?
No, I think that's it. I mean, we could probably waffle on for a while, but, you know, we've got stuff to do.
Best not, eh? Yeah, excellent. David, great to talk to you again.
And you.
And listeners, thank you very much for sharing your time with us. Get in touch, as usual, podcast@constructionindex.co.uk. Particularly interested to hear about your experiences with artificial intelligence and whether it's been changing or ruining your life.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Do tell us. But from David and I, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.